This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Very pleased today, really, really happy to welcome David Shapiro as our guest speaker. He's a longtime friend of Jikoji's, a longtime friend of our emeritus teacher, Shoho Roshi. He became a student of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche in 1973, and studied with him until his death in 1987. David was the founding director of the Milwaukee Dharma Study Group, now the Shambhala Center, and was a practicing internist for over three decades. Currently, he is a member of the Light of Bharatsana Translation Group and continues to practice in the context of Tibetan Buddhism. We are grateful and honored to have him here with us today. And he's going to discuss one of my favorite teachings that's much more prevalent in Tibetan teachings than in Zen. And we really are happy to welcome you. Thank you for being here.
Well, it's a great honor to be here. Thank you so much for those lovely words. Sometimes when I hear introduction, I think, well, that sounds like it might be interesting. I hope it's a good talk. But then sometimes it's me who's talking. So it's kind of the fearful sort of thing. And we're going to try to do something perhaps a little bit different. But don't look at your handouts yet. I'll tell you when they become irrelevant to the talk. And you do get to keep them. So there are some mistakes on them, but that's what happens when you download stuff from the internet. It's a tremendous pleasure to be here. I love this place. It's spectacular. It incorporates all of the positive energy that Buddhism, as well as all people, try to endow this physical plane with. And so for that reason, it is a very sacred space, and a space, of course, that we're sharing together. And as Buddhists, of varying degrees, we share a tremendous similarity. We are far more alike than we are different. It's similar to the way all people share 99.8% of their genetics with all other people. We sometimes dwell on that other little bit, but fundamentally we're all pretty much the same soup. In fact, you share more with a banana than you don't share, but that's a whole different story. But we're mostly all alike. And so we're going to talk about a part of Buddhism that you might not be that familiar with, as you mentioned, and how that shapes some of the things that we're going to discuss today. So it's in broad, general sense, there are different types of Buddhism. Different almost levels, you might say, different growths historically in the Buddhist pantheon. Yet within all the different schools of Buddhism, there's a tremendous amount of similarities. There's a transcendent state. There's some sense of a goal, may or may not be formless, it may or may not be without thought, but there's some kind of absolute goal. And along the way towards that goal, there's how do you act? There's a sense of, we have to be kind to others, and we have to be kind to the planet. And so if you look at the three, we sometimes call them yanas. Yana is a Sanskrit word for vehicle. The three vehicles. The first vehicle is known as the Theravadin, or Hinayana vehicle. where mindfulness and awareness is stressed, and a certain quality of working with thoughts in a very direct way, path of mindfulness. And then there's a Mahayana, which sort of developed after that, and has, as we heard earlier, some context about attempting to understand relationships between form and emptiness, emptiness and form. And then there's Vajrayana, or Tantric Buddhism, which we're going to discuss today. And that goes just a little bit further. So if we look at one way of thinking about it is we sometimes talk about the two truths, the truth of the absolute and the truth of the relative. So at the absolute level, these three yanas, these three vehicles, have a slightly different take on what the absolute goal is, what the final resting place might be. So that in Theravadan schools, Hinayana schools, there's a sense of appreciation of cessation. So those things that are conflicting emotions, those things that are thoughts, come to rest in a place of equanimous peace. And they talk about joy and peace and love and equanimity as the four virtues within the Theravadan or Hinayana path. In Mahayana, we talk about form and emptiness. We talk about shunyata. We talk about going beyond the duality and resting in that space where the duality no longer exists, and extinguishing that. And in Tantra, we talk about that, and what's added to that is quality of luminosity. That when form is emptiness and emptiness is form, yet there still is a luminous quality to the nature of existence. And in Vajrayana or Tantra, the practice is named or aimed, I should say, at appreciating that energy, the quality of that energy. Now, when you're drawing in the absolute truth, or perhaps I should say glimpsing the absolute truth, or conceptualizing the absolute truth on your cushion or at other times, and your mind stops and you find yourself groundless, and there's just the space around you. That lasts for a period of time, momentarily, but for the most part, that's not where we dwell. For the most part, we live in the world of relative truth. And in this world of relative truth, you might have noticed there's a lot of other people living. And they all live in that world of relative truth also. And they don't dwell in that absolute space either. And we may notice that in our interactions with all of those other people, things come up, emotions come up, not always very positive emotions. And so in the world of relative truth, we deal with emotionality. And those three vehicles have a little bit different way of relating to emotions, or what we might, or what is commonly called conflicting emotions. Because a lot of times your emotion may not be the same as the person with whom you're interacting. In fact, not uncommon that people experience conflict of one kind or another, either with family members or co-workers, or even here within the Sangha. That's been known to occur. In fact, for those of us who were sitting for short periods of time, it might have even occurred during that sitting practice. You might have noticed that you had a thought that wasn't so nice about this other person, or that was too nice about this other person. And that's the realm in which we actually exist. So in the Hinayana or Theravadan schools, the notion of how do you deal with conflicting emotions is that you have this big basket. We all have this big basket of different emotions. And they basically label some of them as positive. They see generosity as an emotion, or love as an emotion, and and compassion as an emotion. And so their idea is that they promote the positive emotions that come up in day-to-day existence. And at the same time, they have an equally large category known as negative emotions: aggression, hatred, lust, whatever. And their idea is they minimize that. And so that's sort of, it's kind of like the scale of justice. They try to maximize their positive emotionality and minimize the negative emotionality, all the time moving towards a field of equanimity. In Mahayana, in the next iteration, it's a little bit different, because the Mahayana path, of course, is the path of the Bodhisattva, where the prime directive is to put off your own enlightenment until every blade of grass has made it through. Obviously, kind of a big ask. But the idea is there is that the constant striving of putting others forward. And so one's own emotions are not such a big deal, because the process is one of putting others ahead of oneself. And while emotions will come up, I think that general instruction is not to feed the emotion, and also not to ignore the emotion, but to sort of carve that famous middle way that so many people kind of try to get through somehow. I mean, I know it's there, but it can sometimes seem like, anyway, there's a middle way between repressing emotions and acting them out. And that's sort of the general Mahayana instruction. And I apologize for simplifying kind of everything, but we have to get through this talk, and it has to still be today when it's over. So there you have it. So we have those two, not really conflicting, but slightly different approaches to uncomfortable emotionality, which we acknowledge is part of our existence. In Tantra, in Vajrayana, it's quite different. In a way, I think it's probably, despite the publicity that Tantra in general may get, it's probably the most radical thing about Tantra is the relationship of the practitioner to their emotions, or at least the intended relation. Because emotions in Tantra are not positive or negative, they simply kind of are. They are the nature of your existence, the relative nature of the world in which you constantly exist. And people have tendencies to have one emotion, and this is sort of, we'll get to this in some detail in just a moment, but people have a tendency to sort of have one set of emotions prevalent over other sets of emotions. I had a discussion, my wife and I had a discussion the other day about free will. And lots of philosophers of free will believe that free will barely exists, if at all. And that's obviously a discussion for another day. But one of the things about free will would be that it would posit that you didn't have a tendency towards a particular emotional state. And in fact, one of the teachings of the Buddha suggests that that's not likely to be the case. We do have tendencies, innate somehow tendencies, and if one were to believe in reincarnation, one might think these came from countless ago. Or if one believed in nature and nurture, one would believe that these tendencies are part of one's nature and the nurture that was piled on top of one's genetics. So all these are possibilities. And so the radical notion is that the emotion itself is neither positive or negative. And the instruction is to not dwell in the emotion, not to repress it, not to enable it, and not even, in a sense, to believe in it, but to feel the energy that's underneath the emotion. And the quality of energy there gets back to that luminosity, that the overwhelming energy and luminosity of the universe is mirrored in all of us. And we use that energy, if you will, been said by others before me, in an alchemical way to transmute the neurotic emotionality into enlightened wisdom. And so that's the flip. It's kind of a big flip. From into Tantra. And so the instruction to the student, if they were to recognize emotions as they come up, isn't to deal particularly with the emotion, but to step into it, a step back, or whatever it would be, I have no idea where it is, into the energy that's coming up with the emotion. So that when aggression arises, rather than acting it out or saying, oh, that's a bad thing, there's an energy that comes up with the aggression. And you use that energy to transmute that emotion into wisdom. And so that's what we're going to talk about. And the way that this is generally or discussed, or one way it's discussed, I should say, or one way it's instructed, is through the five Buddha families. And so you can look at your, you can share the screen, and you can look at your handout, and you can take these home. And the five Buddha families is a mandala, like any mandala or matrix. It's got a center and it's got a fringe. And we're going to go through this in a little bit of detail. We're going to take two spins around. And the first spin, and there's a lot of stuff in here that we're not going to talk about. We're going to talk about a skanda, which is the heap, like form, feeling, perception, concept, and consciousness. Each one of them has a Buddha family. And they have each one of them has an icon. There's a vajra and a scepter and a flower and a jewel and a wheel and something else, a sword. And we're not going to talk about that either. And each one of them has a named Buddha. So Buddha is the Buddha of the Buddha family. And Ratnasambhava is the Buddha of the Ratna family. We're not going to talk about that either. But we're going to talk about the rest of it. And so in the center is the Buddha. And to the east is the Vajra. And to the south is Ratna. And to the west is Padma. And to the north is Karma. And there's no particular order. I mean, there's an order. I mean, Lord knows there's an order to everything in Buddhism. And there's numbers and there's series and there's all that. But then there's an order here. But the order in which you go through these does not like a hierarchy. So I will say at the beginning that the Buddha family pervades all of this. And when Trungpa first, my teacher Trungpa referred to earlier, first presented this stuff in the mid-70s, there was a tendency, as he taught about the five different Buddha families, for everybody to sort of say, oh, that person is so Vajra. And that person over there is so karma, and that person over there is so Buddha. And in a way that it just shows the innate ability of people to pigeonhole and to gossip. And actually, some linguists, of course, believe that language began for gossip alone, just as numbers began for trade. Language itself stepped back. It was really just to talk about your neighbor and to say, did you hear? Did you? Did you get this dirt? Anyway, so people did that for a long time. And then finally, it became clear that people are an amalgamation of all five Buddha families. People may have predominant traits, but there isn't a person that doesn't have all five. And you may recognize yourself, and you may have already characterized your best friends without even having gone through this, or the people you live with, or the people you wished you lived with, or the people you're glad you don't live with, or maybe even some of the people who are running the country. You might characterize them as a particular Buddha family with particular tendencies. And to some degree, that would be accurate, but it's not the whole thing. It's never the whole thing. The whole thing is that we're all, you know, we're all five. You know, it's kind of, if you ever watch the kid eat, there's a bunch of different things on the plate. By the end of the meal, they're all kind of mixed together. You know, at least they were when I was growing up, and it was me. Anyway, and it's, yeah, still true, I think. So starting in the East, and you may refer to your sheet if you like, is, and so each of these, I should say, has a, in addition to things we're not going to talk about, they have a color, and they have a season, and they have an emotion, and they have a wisdom. So in the East is the Vajrabuddha family. And it's winter, but it sure is not a California winter. It bears no relationship to California winter. So those of you who have lived someplace real, where they have real winters, where it's northern or midwest, it is 28 degrees below zero. And the ground is frozen with snow, and the snow has a bluish tint. And the sky has a painful, painful blueness to it. And so Vajra is the color blue. And it's winter, and it's cold, and it's frigid, and it's sharp, and it's analytical, and it's clear. And actually, it's a little too clear. It's a little too analytic. It's a little too, I want to get to the bottom of this. I am never going to stop drilling into this problem. I am going to take this problem and I am going to dissect it until there is nothing left. And so the Vajra neurosis, if you will, the neurotic Vajra mind is this sharp, clear, biting depth to every situation, not letting go. And in the depths of that clarity, in the depths of that sharpness, there's an irritation that arises because not everybody's on that wavelength. And that irritation may transmute into anger or aggression or even hatred. So the negative quality of the Vajrabuddha family is hatred. And so if you delve into that, the energy of that is the clarity that sees the situation clearly, the sharpness, the energy of the sharpened blade. You know, you have that thing of a blade when it's so sharp, or a sword when it's so sharp, has an energy even before you use it. It's just self-existing. The energy of that sharpness, overbearing. And the mutation, the alchemical transmutation of that is into mirror-like wisdom. So mirror-like wisdom is that sharpness, but all of a sudden it's in a mirror where the phenomenal world itself is reflected. And so mirror-like wisdom is the wisdom form of the Vajrabuddha family. So we get the general gist here. We've got a season, we've got a color, we've got a neurosis, and we have a wisdom. And so we're leaving winter now. We're actually going kind of, it's a funny season the way we're doing this, because we're going to go backwards, which is difficult. So now it's late fall. And we're visiting the Ratna family. Ratna is Sanskrit for jewel or wealth, sort of same notion. And it's this golden yellow, just this, it's sort of, it's not just autumn, but here California will work. It's kind of, it's late autumn and everything has begun, actually not begun, everything has rotted. The trees have fallen during the summer. They've started to rot. In fact, maybe they fell the summer before. And they're so rotten that mushrooms are growing on top of them. And the wood itself is so rich and fertile that these mushrooms are going crazy. But then if you went to try to pick up the wood, it's so rotten that it crumbles in your hands. It's too rich. It's a ratna. The ratna, richness of ratna is too rich. It's overwhelming. It's the end of it's in your pantry at the end of harvest. And the shelves of your pantry are burdened by the harvest because they can't really handle it. It's the friend that you have that gives you so much stuff that makes you crazy. They're just constantly giving and giving. And that's the ratna thing. That's the richness of ratna, overwhelming the environment, constantly putting out to the extent that the environment is okay already. Got it. Thank you. And what's wrong on this sheet is it says that the emotion is greed, but it isn't greed, it's pride. Because the rotten person does that because they're so proud of themselves that they feel that they can just give and give and give and give and give and give. And that's the neurosis, it's the pride. But the fear of that pride is that you might get criticized or somebody might think you're not doing the right thing. And even though you're this wonderful, rich person constantly giving out, somebody might not think perfectly of you. And your answer to that is to give out more. So you're kind of the person who's slightly overwhelming the environment around themselves in a nice way, you think. But the environment might not agree. The energy of that comes from the interaction of understanding the prideful quality behind it, as well as the generosity that is manifested from it. And wisdom is known as the wisdom of equanimity, because in Ratna wisdom, there's this balance between understanding your desire to give and the goodness of giving itself. It's not a one way, just it's understanding. Trungpa Rinpoche had a term of it known as enlightened, of non-idiot compassion, enlightened compassion, compassion that understands the boundaries of what you can do in the phenomenal world. So that's Ratna. And moving back in time, we get to spring. And this is in the south, is the Padma family. And Padma literally means lotus, sometimes flower, but really lotus. It's this sort of overwhelming lotusy flowers come up out of the mud. It's filled with metaphor, but this is just a lot of flower. And it's red, it's a deep red. And it's the deep, very, very seductive, velour red of the cabaret, my friend. The cabaret where you get lost in a myriad of desire. And it's desire, it's the realm of desire. And it's a desire in the sense of lust. It's nothing, just to be clear about it. It's a neurotic desire. And it's the desire that doesn't really want unity. with the thing that its object of love or its object of desire. It kind of wants possession. So there's a desire that is free flowing. And then there's a desire that the energy of which that desire is the desire to possess. Not the desire to dance, but the desire to possess. And the desire in the Padma family, in the neurotic sense, is that desire that wants control. Or to be controlled. Probably the same thing. Anyway, so the energy that has to do with that is the energy of spring. That's what we talk about this season last. Spring is sort of like it's when the birds and the bees do their thing, right? It's when life is, the plants have been planted, the seeds have been planted, and they're coming up, and life is budding. And so it's actually the energy of life itself. It's the energy of newly emerging form, newly emerging life, coming up, and manifesting in the world. And so the Padma family energy is this energy of renewal, if you will, rebirth in the spring, how stuff arises. And how stuff begins to manifest. And so the transmutation, the wisdom of the Padma family, is the wisdom of discriminating awareness. And this discriminating awareness has a kind of slight Vajra tone to it, because it's a sense of understanding the difference between possession and unity. The wisdom of discriminating awareness, or it's, yes, the wisdom of discriminating awareness is the wisdom of true unity, of coming together without possession, without possessiveness. It's the dance itself, the primordial dance that all beings can relate to. And so it's beyond the concept of possession. I always struggled with the term discriminating awareness, because But it makes some kind of sense, because what you're seeing, what you're discriminating, is between the desire to possess and the desire to be one with something. And it's not easy sometimes. So that's why it's the wisdom of discriminating awareness. Well, spring gives way to summer, and the deep, rich green of the Karma Buddha family. Karma, as you undoubtedly all know, is a Sanskrit word for action or activity. In this sense, it is probably more like activity than particular action. It's not particularly related to, you know, your individual karma at all. But it's related to activity. And it's summer, it's sort of towards the end of summer, where stuff is like growing like too much. It's busy. It's so busy, and so much stuff is being done. It's too busy. Too much stuff is being done. If one more zucchini blossoms, I'm gonna die right on the spot. It's a field too fertile. It's too many chores, and it's too many chores being done. And I might not get it all done. And there's the karma edge. The karma is about activity, but it's about too much activity. It's about being too busy. And the neurotic emotion in a karma family is somewhere between the paranoia that you might not get your chores done, and the jealousy that somebody else might have gotten theirs done. And that you live in this constant fear, the karma fear of not being first, not getting it all done. You've got this list, and maybe it's in your reminders. Maybe it's on a piece of cardboard. Maybe it's on a little sheet next to your computer, and you check them off, and you check them off, and check them off. At the end of the day, they might not all be done. And somebody else, you don't even know who they are, might have a longer list. They might have gotten them all done. Bad, very bad. Anyway, the energy behind that, you can feel, you can almost feel the energy between that's manifesting between the quality of busyness and the feeling that you might not get it done. We've all had days like that. Like, it's just too much on this plate. I've really done a lot. I might get it all done, but I might not get it all done. But it's that energy that lives in that land of limbo between completion and attempt, and the paranoia and the jealousy and the competitiveness that dwells there. And so it's that energy that you tap for the alchemical transmutation of the karma family neurosis, which has the unfortunate name of all accomplishing wisdom. Because then it sort of feels like, well, then I guess they did get it all done. But it really has more of the sense that those things that needed to be done got done. There's in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a saying that there's four actions, what needs to, how does that go? What needs care gets its care. What needs
whatever needs to be destroyed will be destroyed at the end.
Yeah, there's four of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, next time I'll come armed with those. Oh, that's not what it is. It's magnetizing.
Enriching,
magnetizing, ennobling, and destroying. Four types of activity. But the anyway, the all accomplishing wisdom is the quality of putting the right thing, the right activity with the right necessity, with the right need. And so it's accomplishing in the sense of more knowing what to do. Last time we get to the Buddha family, which has no season because the Buddha family pervades all the other four Buddha families. And the Buddha family is generally seen to be white, but it's kind of a very weak white. We have the word pellucid or limpid, or slightly grayish, translucent, almost slightly ghostly, sickly white. Maybe it's Voldemort white. It's not quite of this world white. And it's ignorance is its emotion, which we may not think of so much as an emotion, as a fact, but this ignorance is the ignorance that desires ignorance. Mm-hmm. Well, something in Tibetan we say ma rigpa. Rigpa is insight, ma is just the negation of that. This is the primordial insight from which duality itself arises. That prior to them being, or you being, or us being, or they being, there's that cosmic soup, if you will, that primordial isness that still is, that exists. And this ignorance is the ignorance of that. So it's the deepest level of ignorance. It's well beyond any of the other four Buddha families. And actually, it spawns the other four Buddha families, because it's that primordial ignorance from which all of the other emotions arise. And we see that within the Buddha family. The wisdom of the Buddha family is the all-pervasive, or the wisdom of all-pervasive space. And it comes about when within that ignorance, which is so limpid, and so weak, and so dense, is just a little sliver, just a little cut. And that cut goes all the way down to the groundless state of existence. And we perceive that. And the energy of that sliver is the energy that's used to transmute ignorance into the wisdom of all pervasive space. So that concludes our little tour of the five Buddha families. Basic notion is that as emotions arise for any practitioner or any person, frankly, you've got a lot of choices. You can do it, you can not do it, you can half do it, you can half not do it, you can follow it away for another day. If it's a strong enough emotion, you know it's coming back. If it's a weak emotion, it may take a holiday. Within the realm that we've discussed today, you have another option, which is to explore the energy that is underlying the emotion as it arises. And then to do something with that energy, just looking at it, just tasting it, perhaps knowing that there are other options rather than the ones that you might have previously been considering. And that's the array of the five Buddha families. It's a tool, you know, and sometimes when you have a new tool, you know, that old saw about how when you got a really new hammer, everything's a nail. Well, this is a tool, but don't use it everywhere. But think about it from time to time, and perhaps you'll find it of some value. Anyway, thank you so much for coming. Thank you so much for inviting me. If there's time and interest in any questions, now might be a good time.
Thank you very much. So yeah, why did you go in that order of it was like winter to fall, then popped over to spring and then summer? Yeah, I know you said the order doesn't necessarily matter, but why did you choose that one?
Well, that's the way it's a rule. You know, Tibetans love mandalas and they love tankas. And tankas always have directions. They always have four directions in the center. And the seasons don't necessarily go around. And they're not always arrayed in this, depending on whose mandala it is. This is the mandala of the Buddha, actually. And in the mandala of the Buddha, Vajra is always to the east, and the east is always in the bottom of a tanka. And Padma is always in the south. And Padma
west
just happens to
the west,
to west, I'm sorry. Ratna's in the south. Good thing we've got her here, I can tell you. For lots of reasons. But anyway, so Padma is always in the west. And Ratna is always in the south, and Karma is always in the north, in all Buddha mandalas, I'm pretty sure. Whereas if somebody else, some other deity was in the center, it might be arrayed differently. And so the seasons are attached to particular Buddha families. And I just wanted to go around like this because it was easier for me. I could easily have gone in any order. But, and actually maybe it makes more sense to start with winter. You know, but then it's so cold. Well, we did start with winter. Whoops. But then I could have gone to spring. You know, gone from so cold to so just didn't want to go from blue to red, the clashing colors. So it took a little yellow detour. I have no idea. No friggin' idea, frankly. Yeah.
Oh, I thank you for your talk.
Sure.
I'm wondering if you can explain a little more the difference between expressing an emotion and exploring the energy of the emotion.
Oh, sure. In simplest terms, expressing emotion, let's use anger. You're acting out your anger. And however you're doing that, be it email or gun, doesn't really matter. It's your choice. But you're actually expressing the emotion. Well, the idea is that the energy of the emotion comes from something deeper than just the anger. It comes from you. And that you have qualities beyond simply shooting an email or a gun. And that you're going to use those qualities to find a different mode of expression that's going to, in the Vajra sense, allow you to see the other, to give you, use the clarity of the Vajra mind to see the other side, generally. You might still shoot the email or the gun. I'm not taking that off the table. I'm suggesting there may be some depth to that approach. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you for
sure.
And I want to ask a follow-up question. So,
yeah.
So based on the expressed emotion, like anger, like how can we transform this bad emotions into our inner energy?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you have any suggestion for that?
Well, there's beer. No. It's a practice. It actually is a practice. It's a very specific practice. So if this was a Theravadin class or this a mindfulness class, there would be an instruction that would say when emotions came up, analyze the emotion and try to come up with an antidote for that emotion. So if anger comes up, you come up with an antidote for anger, which might be, you know, taking a time out or being a nice person or not being angry or still being angry at them, but being nice to somebody else. There's lots of things you could do other than just acting out that emotion. So that would be an actual practice. Anger comes up. Here's what you do with it as a Theravadin or as a mindfulness practitioner, right? In the Mahayana, the emotion comes up.
Are you muted?
Was that wrong?
That was not critique. That was a dog. Sorry. I unmuted. Sorry. Sorry about that.
Sound of agreement.
Dogs are very good listeners, mostly. Anyway, where were we? Oh, yeah. So we're having anger in the Mahayana schools. And so anger comes up, same thing. And there's that notion of middle way, of not acting it out, not repressing it, but sort of working with it. And that's an actual instruction. The idea is that tools are instructions. So if you have instruction, you know, they have this way of walking here. Have you noticed it? It's kind of slow. You know, between meditation, they walk, they pick their feet up kind of slowly, and then they push their heels down, and they move forward a little bit. Well, it's an instruction. It's a tool. Just like you got meditation instruction, they told you to sit a particular way and maybe follow your breath or have some sense of awareness. Or I don't know what you guys do here, but there's a sense of an actual instruction. Well, here there's an actual instruction also. And the instruction is, kind of simply, but you know, a lot of simple things are not easy to do. You know, it's simple to play the flute, relatively, but it's not easy to play it really well. And so it's the same kind of thing. Lots of things are simple. So it's a simple instruction. the conflicting emotion comes up of anger. And the instruction is to step back, step in. Don't worry, and not even, it's not about, this is a different instruction for a different time. It's not about feeling the quality of anger. It's not about sort of filling it out. It's like it's stepping back into it. There are other instructions, which might be when anger comes up, exaggerate it. Make it its fullest self while you're on the cushion here. This is not an email or gun kind of situation. And manifest that emotion strongly as possible. And that's actually another Vajrayana instruction. But that's a different tool. This tool is the emotion comes up and you go back to see where in you that emotion, the energy came to have that emotion. And that's the, so it's not easy. It's simple. You simply go back and tap that energy. But you don't easily go back. That's why it's an instruction. That's why it's a technique. That's why it's a practice. Because even once you've done that, with anger, for instance, it's possible anger will come up again sometime. Maybe minutes later. Maybe not a whole minute. Maybe an hour. But not longer than that. And so you get another shot at it. You know, it's kind of like combing your hair. You keep combing. You don't ever have to stop that hair. Just keep combing. Well, this is the same thing. You've got emotions. They're not stopping either. There isn't an end to this line. You know, it's not a train. It's up. Oh, everybody out. Mm-mm. It's just emotions all the way down. Just like there used to be turtles. This is just emotions all the way down.
Thank you so much.
Certainly. Yeah.
You've got a question. And I think, you know, what your answer just now kind of helped the understanding. But I still have a question about, you know, like the energy that these emotions hold and their own desire to be expressed, you know, the transmutation mm-hmm. and the insight into looking into what the energy and reasons behind these emotions are,
mm-hmm.
Very helpful. I'm still wondering though about the expression, like we want to express the good emotions and the, you know, the positivity, mm-hmm. but the negative sure. also has this charge and this mm-hmm. this desire to be expressed equally.
Right.
So, you know, and at the beginning, I remember you mentioned the promoting the good emotions and kind of, and not the negative mm-hmm. ones. Mm-hmm. That's sort of an instruction. And there's other instructions that help you not mm-hmm. repress the negative, but I just wondered, how could we, you know, is there instruction or a similar tool that could help us to express the negative emotion as it desires to be expressed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, that's very good. That's the whole point, really, isn't to harvest the good emotions and plow under your bad emotions. You know, there's an analogy of the wise farmer and the foolish farmer. You know them? Well, the foolish farmer goes to the field store and buys compost and manure and brings it back and puts it on the field. And the wise farmer uses the compost and manure from their own farm. So that's the idea. It's your compost, it's your manure, whether it's positive or negative. You don't go somewhere else looking for it. And you don't even particularly dwell on whether it's a positive or a negative emotion. You know, it's just what's there. Mm-hmm. And so the idea, though, I guess, would be that if there's energy behind a negative emotion, you use that energy and attempt to transmute it And the Buddha families, in the only the most general sense, would say, well, I'm feeling, emotion of paranoia, because I'm trying to get so much stuff done. So that's karma, Buddha family. So I'll transmute it into all accomplishing wisdom. It doesn't need to be so detailed as that. It's just simply, I'm feeling this need to get something done. Let's take that energy and make it something useful. That's all. It's simple, just not easy.
I've got a question for you, David. Can I? No? Sorry?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. the five Buddha families. So we embody all five of the Buddha families, and yet there's, as we sort of look at this map, there's one that seems to be our pervasive place. When we consider like both the negative and positive qualities of all the Buddha families and kind of look at this map like a psychological guide, I guess you'd say, or just to find out our place, do we try and integrate all the Buddha families together, or do we try and how do we relate with this map? How do we relate to our both the negative and the positive, mm-hmm. and our dominant and passive mm-hmm. qualities, mm-hmm. and I mean, actually, how do we use the hammer, you know, that you talked about? So, yeah.
Well, first you get a sorting hat. Sorting hat? Come on, sorting hat. No? Harry Potter, sorting hat. To figure out which one you are. Because you might be wrong. If you don't have a sorting hat, you could ask some of your friends.
They tell you. Yeah.
I'll tell you for sure.
Yeah.
You'd probably be right.
Yeah.
And so you may have a predominant Buddha family that if you either have a sorting hat or you have some friends, I mean, if you had friends, I mean, if you were to have friends, then they might be able to tell you what is your predominant Buddha family. And then if you agree, or if you think that's useful information, then the idea would be you would start to see how that tendency flavors your actions in the world. And it wouldn't be necessarily that it would change anything. I mean, you're way too old to change anything. As
granted.
Well, yeah. But it may be helpful in dealing with the world. It may answer some questions. I mean, it's sort of like any, you know, you go to a therapist, you go to any kind of psychological thing, they sort of say, you know, you have a tendency to get angry really easily. You have a tendency to want everybody to like you. You have a tendency to just not want to be involved with anybody but your own brain. I mean, these are all possibilities, and we all have all of these at one point or another. And I think if you can identify that I, for instance, I take criticism really badly, so I don't say anything bad about this talk. And that's just part of my rotten self, and it's not my whole self. But there's a hunk of it there. And there's some people here who know that really well, because occasionally they'll try to correct my posture, which it happens to be terrible. But the very act of beginning to correct it, I see all kinds of colors, and none of them are nice. And it doesn't make me a nice person all of a sudden. So I know that. Mm-hmm. I've known that for years. It hasn't done a bit of good. Mm-hmm. But I like knowing. And it's not the only thing that I am. I have some other qualities, I think, but I think it's in a way it's helpful, because I know when I stand up straight and I smirk and I sneer and I growl, I know that's me, because I feel injured because my pride is so overwhelming. I can't imagine that anybody could correct me. Mm. Would you have any idea how neurotic that is? Mm. That is way neurotic. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. And so everybody has that. Everybody has a quality like that. And I think recognizing it is of some value. It hasn't helped yet. But that's how you use those things. And you either self-identify with the Buddha family, or you get somebody to help, or you get a hat, or, you know, you can take this thing and can throw a flower on it. This is done at some tantric things. You throw a flower and see where it lands, and that's you. I had to do that once, but I didn't like where it landed. But I just forgot where it landed. I could never remember where it landed. I spent 4 years preparing for this one thing, and I knew it was coming. And I threw my flower, but my eyes were closed, and then on to the next person, and my flower was everywhere. I still don't know what it was. But I believe it was rotten. But I don't really know that. Yeah. I'm not sure I ever told anybody that. Anyway, stuff happens. So you decide anyway you want to decide. You can always have, you know, I don't know what, Ratna Thursday and Padma Friday, Karma Saturday, and sort of see if it fits me. Anyway.
Yeah, it'd be fun to play with. Yeah.
When you see these personalities depicted in art?
These personalities in art?
In your, these five, in fact, Tibetan art or...
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, these are all, if you Google five Buddha families, they'll show you a whole bunch of different tankas. And rather than having them written out, they have the five Buddha families. So they have Ratna Sambhava and Varachana and Buddha and Amago City. But rather than having these things, they have those Buddhas with their icons.
I think about these faces, these personality faces,
yeah.
I see.
Yeah, I think they probably have it that way too. Sure. Yeah. But this was, something I found. This was actually on a seminar on suicide. Mm-hmm. It didn't have these colors. I added the colors.
I have a question. Since you put your toe in the water of free will, I'm interested in that as well. And I'm wondering whether or not you would go so far as to say that these neurotic kind of go-to responses are functionally willful.
Functionally willful? You mean they act by themselves, or they cause people to act?
That we choose them.
Or we choose them.
I'm not saying... Mm-hmm. Okay, are you with me?
Yeah, I think so. I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, it seems, you know, people grow up with, you know, a very complex personality structure. This is a very simple tool for looking at it.
Well, the way I'm looking at it is that, you know, once I'm aware that I have a tendency, which I see myself in my there very clearly, and if once I'm aware I have a tendency, then I have a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's the choice.
Right. Yeah.
If I choose to go, you know, predictably, let's say, mm-hmm. knee jerk, mm-hmm. then
you have a choice there.
I have a choice.
Yes.
That's willful.
That's definitely willful.
Yeah. Well, don't we have a choice if we're paying
attention? Well, that's the question, isn't it? Let's say we're not so much paying attention, but we're driven by the emotions of one of the Buddha families. Mm. And that Buddha family happens to be Vajra. And we happen to get really angry. Can you use that as a defense? Probably not. I mean, it won't work very well, at least not in this country. But on the other hand, psychological tendencies probably, whether they're manifested or discussed in terms of the five Buddha families or in some other way, probably do color the way that people act. And so to the degree that those actions are colored or tinged or whatever, it's maybe a little less than free will. Yes, you certainly have the ability, always have the ability. Choices are without end. The human realm is without end in choice. So you have that ability. But other people might not even have that tendency. And so they wouldn't have to make that choice. Mm-hmm. But they would have other choices they would have to make. So in that sense, certainly, I guess it's willful.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.